welcome to Being Professional English Podcast, podcast number 73, Negotiating, part 3. Let's get started, shall we? Hello and welcome to this podcast, Negotiating Part 3, the third and I think the final part for the moment on the negotiating series that I've started 3 weeks ago. First of all, I want to apologise if any of you hear a humming sound in the background. I have the air conditioning unit on, which I rarely have on here in Italy, but at the moment in northern Italy, in Verona where I live, we are suffering from a very hot and humid period. So even though it is almost 10 o'clock at night on a Sunday, I still have to have the air conditioning on. I hope it doesn't cause any listening issues for any of you. Okay, so the third part of the negotiating series, and I'm going to have four sections to this today. The first of which is, like in previous weeks, I'm going to quickly go through a quick introduction from what we've done the last 2 weeks. Then I will go over to rule number 5, which is skip the contentious parts. Rule number 6, which is agree any price if you control the terms. And rule number 7, which is know the rules of influence, which introduces another topic, which is very interesting. So let's talk a little bit about what we have been talking about. Obviously, if you are new to my podcast and just listening to it now, I would advise you to go back and listen to the last 2 weeks. If you have already listened to them, then I'll be very, very brief with this quick introduction. We're talking about negotiating, and we are looking at it because it is one of the more difficult skills that we have to learn, not only for people who are using English or any second language, but also for people using their mother tongue. Now, almost all of these rules that I've given so far are applicable to people who are using their mother tongue. The only difference really is my continued effort, which I've put into these podcasts, in that I think people who are using English as a second language in a professional area have a disadvantage, and we're trying to overcome that disadvantage by becoming hyper effective. Obviously, if you're listening to this podcast, your English is already of a certain level, and I imagine it's close to B1, which is intermediate. In my opinion, if your language is that level, you don't need to study anymore. You have enough grammar and vocabulary to help you. But what you might miss is some of the skills of transferring your professional ability into another language. And that's what the whole basis of my podcasts are about. I went off on a tangent then, I do apologize. Anyway, getting back to negotiation. I've said before that negotiation is a part of life. Everyone does it all the time. The only difference between work and family, or work and private time, is that there's a lot more fear about negotiation at work. And why is that? Is because the lack of the intensity and deep relationships that you have at home, which do not exist at work. There's very little fear of rejection and judgment when you are talking to people and negotiating with people at home. There is a very palatable, that means you can taste it, fear of that rejection when you're doing it at work. And that all goes to say that what myself and a lot of other people talk about is that in business, it's about people, it's about relationships. What negotiation is about, however, is not solely about relationships, but also a lot about psychology. The reason being is there are going to be many negotiations that which you do in which you're not going to be able to have had the luxury of building up a relationship over a period of time before you start your negotiation. And therefore, you have to rely on certain psychological rules and indicators and techniques, as well as purely professional effective management techniques to get you through or to improve your chance. As an example to this, I read somewhere that there was a group of MBA students in America. I forget now the university. I think it was Stanford, but I'm not sure. And they got these two groups, put them into two groups, and they asked one group to begin having a series of negotiations between them. You know, they're putting people into pairs, into threes, and then groups in that way. And this first group, they were told that time is money, so just get straight into the negotiation. With the second group, they were told that before they started on the negotiation, that they should exchange some personal information, trying to find where they have some connection with the other people. You know, like, I love swimming, and someone else says, yeah, well, I do that too every morning, and, you know, so that's that sort of stuff. Very banal connections. Now, the fantastic thing about this was, oh, now I remember, it's actually two universities, wasn't it? It was Stanford and Harvard, that's it, two universities. And the fantastic thing about this is that the first group who went straight into negotiation, they only 33% of the groups arrived at an agreement. With the second group, who would exchange a little bit of information about each other, not much, 90% arrived at an agreement, of which 75% of those people said the agreement works for both parties. Pretty amazing, right? For just asking what sport you do. It's all based upon relationships and psychology. The rules we've looked at so far, we started 2 weeks ago and we said everything is negotiable. Negotiation is about life, just jump in and get on with the game. Then I spoke about ask your way to success, in that if you don't ask, you don't get. The worst that can happen is the person can say no. Last week I spoke about preparation being key, quite obvious, but I went into some detail of what that preparation is. And then I spoke about the different types of power that you see in a negotiation. That's what I did the last 2 weeks. On to this week. Rule number 5, skip the contentious parts. It's a very, very simple rule to follow, and actually quite a pleasurable one. Deeply based in psychological analysis of how human beings work. The fact is, every negotiation has parts. If anyone has ever negotiated something, you know, a contract, for instance, you're going to have many articles, you know, 10, 20, 30. So, I mean, some people work on these things, have 40 pages of agreements. And they are subdivided into sections, and then those sections are subdivided into particular points. Going through this negotiation or contract or whatever it seems to be, the most effective way to approach it is that you agree on the sections you agree on. And the sections which you do not agree on, or whether there's some contention, you just say, very simply, let's come back to this section later. You skip it. If the other party wants, oh, no, I want to talk about this now, you try to dissuade them from that, because you don't want to get bogged down in something which is not particularly working. And it's not just that. The reason you're doing it is because otherwise you lose the habit of agreeing. there's a consultant, what's his name now? Alan Wise, that's it, Alan Wise. And he's written a couple of books about how to be an excellent consultant. And he does a lot of work on how to write proposals. And when he talks about proposals, he says that you should go through each of the sections, allowing the person reading it to agree to each of them. So the first section of proposal will be a history of the client's company. Then would be maybe some of the objectives that the actual consultation is meant to achieve. And then how you would measure those objectives. And what, if they did achieve those objectives, what it would mean to the customer. So you go through those all before you get to the bit about the price that they have to pay. So they get used to saying, I agree, I agree, I agree, I agree. So it's exactly the same here, what we're talking about in terms of going through negotiation. Get into the habit of agreeing. The next rule is a rule which I love. Which I like all the rules, but I particularly like this one. It says, agree any price if you control the terms. Basically, the terms of an agreement are more important than the price. Far too much focus is made on price in these negotiations. Too many people talk about it. And it's strange because the financial considerations of any agreement are obviously very critical, and price level is one of those. And it is obviously important. What's more, terms tend to be more vague. They can be a little bit more complicated to understand. The consequences of them are not so obvious, whereas if the price is 10 or 20, that is very obvious. Whereas if the terms are, you know, paying back in 3 months or a 25% upfront payment and then the rest being paid in 6 months, you know, that's a bit difficult to work out on the fly, as it were, which means in the moment, as to which is preferable. Let me use an extreme example, which I heard on YouTube, which was, let me pay you 20 times worth for your car. So your car's worth $10,000. I'll pay you $200,000 for it. Did I say 20 times? Yeah, okay, $200 for it. Person's like, oh, great. Wow, I'll do that. But the terms are that I'll pay you $1 a time every time I meet you in my favorite bar in Mayfair in London. Now, unless you're an alcoholic and the person you're buying the car from is also an alcoholic, you're not going to meet in that bar that often. So the terms are more important. Now, that's an extreme example, right? But it's to illustrate that you see the point. The consequences of the terms are far more important than the price. And if you're the other party doesn't get that, you can use that to your advantage. Some quick drink of some lovely rum with ice. Lastly, rule number 7 is know the rules of influence. Now, talking about this, I could actually do a complete new podcast. And maybe I will in the future. The rules of influence are mostly based, at least my understanding of them, by the work of a psychologist in America called Robert Cialdini. Obviously he has some Italian heritage there. And his book called Influence. If anyone wants to get or start off on looking and reading some management books, I would recommend that. Not enough emphasis is placed upon the psychology of things, and therefore I'd read it. I would say, however, the book is not the easiest thing in the world to read. I mean, it's a psychology, it's a book about psychology. They're never going to be easy, right? So your English is going to have to be pretty good to listen to it. That's one of the reasons why I probably will do a book summary for people later on. In this book, he analyzes scientifically what are the rules of influence, or the parts, the influential parts of influencing others. And he talks about seven: scarcity, authority, consistency, consensus, liking, and reciprocity, which I have a great difficulty always in pronouncing. Reciprocate, reciprocity. See, I'm mother tongue English, and I have problems pronouncing words, so don't worry about it, guys. And this is an extremely public forum, because I've got hundreds of thousands of people who listen to my podcast. Anyway, I don't want to go through all seven of those now. And to be honest with you, a lot of it is based upon sales as opposed to negotiating. So it's a very specific part of negotiating regarding sales. But I would like to talk about two of the things today. The one of them, of course, is the one that I can't pronounce. Reciprocate, reciprocity, reciprocity. Jesus. Which basically means that you or people are obliged to give back to you when they receive something from you. Simple. If you invite someone to a party or your party, they're more likely to invite you to their party. Okay. If you buy dinner for someone one evening, they're more likely to buy dinner for you another evening, unless you've been boring company, of course. This is a fantastic subject, and it's picked up in a lot of management work, actually, because it's based on relationships, right? And, you know, there's a guy called Simon Sinek who talks about his management style. He's got a wonderful book called Leaders Eat Last, which takes a lot of information from the military, where, I'm not sure if this is all the military, but he talks about the US Marines, where they have a rule that the leader, the most senior officer, always eats last, allows his men, and I guess his women, in the Marine Corps to actually eat first. And he takes that and brings that into the workplace and talks about how organizations and how leaders, to be the most effective, need to make their people feel safe. Safe about not losing their job, safe about not being judged, safe about not being criticized. And he gives some examples, like Southern Airways in America. If you look up about Southern Airways in America, it is a tremendous success story, and it's in an area, it's in a market which is highly competitive. And why is it an extreme success story? Because people go the extra mile, and seriously go the extra mile, to help the customers. And why do they do that? Because the management team at Southern Airways go the extra mile for their employees. You know, I talk to a lot of managers and bosses, and I say, look, if you're a complete bastard, if you treat people badly, how the hell can you expect them to treat your customers well? What is that expression? Your customer's experience will never exceed that of your employee's experience. And it's not, you know, trying to be nice and cuddly and stuff. It's true. It's true. And when I talk about this, people, and when Simon Sinek also talked about it, people bring up, oh, well, you know, look at Steve Jobs. You know, he was a complete tyrant. Well, yes, he was. But two things, and I don't know an awful lot about Steve Jobs, so I bow to people who are far more knowledgeable than me. But from what I've seen of him, yes, he was a tyrant, but he was a genius. So, hey, if you are taking your management style from a genius, then you are setting the bar a little too high, as far as I'm concerned. And secondly, his people loved him. I mean, they loved him. Talk about relationships. They loved it. The management board once didn't, but his people loved him. They'd followed him anywhere. So he also, Simon Sinek, gives an example of a Midwestern company that I can't remember what it's. I think it's in the business of some manufacturing business. And when the financial crisis hit in 2008 or 2009, they lost like 35% of their orders overnight, completely gone. And of course, they had to look at cutting costs. And of course, one of the two biggest costs of a manufacturing company are employees. The other one being the cost of raw material. So employees. So they were looking at sacking. And the new, I think it was the managing director, refused to allow this to happen, saying that it would just cause the company to crumble. But they had to find the savings. I think they had to find something like $10 million over a six-month period. Otherwise, they were going to go out of business. So what he introduced was a four-week compulsory non-paid holiday. Everyone from the top manager down to the lowest person on the ladder had to take 4 weeks unpaid leave. And he said that it is better that we all suffer a little than a few suffer greatly. Now, what was the effect of this? There were two effects. Two effects and one massive consequence, or result, sorry. One effect was that people began to trade their four-week allocation. Some people who could afford to not be paid would take weeks from people who couldn't. So someone, instead of two people having four weeks, one person would say, okay, I'll take two of your weeks. So I'll go 6 weeks non-paid, and you just go 2 weeks, because the other person didn't have the financial resources to do that. So they internally began to trade their holidays. It meant, and it brought people together, right? I mean, it really brought people together in a very stressful situation, and a global situation which was terrible. The result of this was that they actually saved not $10 million in 6 months, but $20 million in 6 months. $20 million in 6 months. Because the people were also incentivized to find savings elsewhere. Amazing. Right? So, people want to reciprocate. They are obliged to give when they receive something from you. In Robert Cialdini's work, Influence, and some of the stuff you can see with him on the internet, he gives another wonderful example, which talks about restaurants. When it comes time to pay the bill, if the waiter brings a mint to eat, to clean the palate, as it were, with the bill, they noticed a 3% increase in the tips given to the waiter. If the waiter gave two mints, there was a 14% increase in tips. And most strangely enough, if the waiter gave one mint, then while walking away from the table, turned around and said, "You people have been so good tonight, so nice, that you deserve another mint," and gave them a second mint, tips went through the roof. They went up to, they went up 25%. Great example, based on fact, based on data, not opinions. The other point I want to talk about is consistency. Consistency means that people like to be consistent with the things they have previously said or done. Now, some of you might be laughing because you know people who are not like this at all, but deep down, human beings want to be like this. This consistency and this feeling that people have, you get when you look for or you ask for commitments that can be made. Small commitments. So when you're in a negotiation, you look and ask for those small commitments that the people can actually give to you. And this helps influence them for bigger things later. The example that Robert Cialdini gives, or one of the examples, is that if I can remember this correctly, they went around to a neighborhood and they asked if they could put a big wooden sign in the garden saying drive safely. And very few people actually said that they could do that, even though they agreed with the actual idea behind, the intent. In a neighborhood very close, very similar, they actually had four times as many people say yes. A 400% increase in take-up. Why? Because 10 days prior to asking the people if they could put a wooden board and notice in their garden, they had given them a little tiny sticker to put in their front window which said drive safely. So people like to be consistent. So they'd already agreed to that sticker. It made it much easier for them, psychologically speaking, to actually agree to the wooden plank. So those are two of the five, of the seven, sorry, fascinating work by Robert Cialdini. I might do a podcast on this subject on its own, but if you can't wait for that, please go and get the book. Amazon.com.it or .wherever you are, buy it and you will like it. You're going to be very good English, but it's worthwhile. You might actually find some translations because it's quite a famous book and it's been around for quite a while. I hope you've enjoyed this podcast. I hope you enjoyed the series of negotiation. I hope you're going to use some of these rules in your next negotiation going to do. Just use one or two, don't use them all, and see what difference that makes to your success, because that's what we're about. You being perceived as you want to be in the workplace, in a second language, in English, which is not easy. Once again, thank you for listening. Good to talk to you. Speak to you again very soon. Bye-bye.